The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation. I'm D.D. Guttenplan, editor of The Nation, and I'm joined this morning by our national affairs correspondent, John Nichols, who's been covering the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. John, it's a pleasure to have you back. It's been a pleasure being with you in Chicago. Let's start from last night. What leapt out at you last night was Kamala Harris's speech, introducing herself officially to the country and the party.
I thought her speech was striking. It was very, very well done in the classic sense. And my first impression was that she chose an approach that clearly distinguishes her from Donald Trump. That's core politics, right? The responsibility of an acceptance speech at a convention is to make your case for why people should look at you. In this year, when Trump remains such a still dominant figure in our politics, what Kamala Harris needed to do was to present a real alternative. And she did that with a classically structured speech, biography up front, some solid domestic policy, and then a strong foreign policy component, which was clearly intended to show her to be a more responsible player than Trump. But what really stood out for me beyond the structure was the fact that Kamala Harris did include a reasonably significant section of the foreign policy discussion focused on Gaza.
And, all right, so let's go there first. After all, we're just talking here.
Yeah.
As you know, Uncommitted brought delegates to the convention who were desperate to get a Palestinian voice on primetime television. And their supporters and the supporters of the Justice for Palestine, Palestine Liberation, whatever you want to call it, movement, and the wider movement to stop this war and stop the slaughter in Gaza were lobbying hard. They were lobbying the DNC hard. They were meeting. You went to a panel which was devoted to Palestinian rights. And that was an official panel, the first official panel ever at a Democratic convention. Talk a little bit about that, and let's go through the process of where we got to Kamala Harris's attempt to thread the needle last night.
Yeah, well, I'll cut to the chase right away and say that they didn't get what they asked for. But Palestinian activists inside the hall and outside made a number of demands. Their core demand, obviously, is for a ceasefire and for an arms embargo that ends the U.S. support of Israel's assault on Palestine, which during this week, we learned, has killed at least 40,000 Palestinian men, women, and children. So this was an urgent call. It wasn't just politics. It's not, you know, kind of the long arc of things. This was an urgent call for action. And you can look at it in two ways. First and foremost, again, that core concept. The DNC did not put a Palestinian speaker on stage, despite the demands of Muslim, Christian, Jewish, left-wing, and sometimes very moderate Democrats.
Unionists, the UAW. Oh,
lots of unions. I mean, literally speakers who were going on saying, I'm glad to be going on at this convention, but I think a Palestinian should be on this stage as well. So there was a lot of cry for it. It did not happen. And that, I think, we put up front because we need to understand that the DNC didn't do what would have been the easiest thing in the world. It's not hard to in this long schedule.
Particularly in a week where they did put the family of an Israeli held hostage. Now, that couple were very moving and very eloquent, and, you know, garnered praise from a wide spectrum of listeners. But it would have been the natural thing, either on the same night, the night before, or the night after, to find space for one Palestinian voice. And yet the Democratic National Committee would not do it.
Exactly. And in what should be understood is that the Uncommitted Movement and their allies submitted a list of many, many Palestinian elected officials from across the United States. And they said to the DNC, you pick, you know, go ahead, take a look at this. They recommended a legislator from Georgia who has a terrific record and wanted to give a very, you know, a very thoughtful and useful speech. And it wouldn't have been long. It could have been done. They didn't do that. And so that's a deep disappointment. By the same token, I do think it's important to understand. I picked up a copy yesterday of the Chicago Sun-Times, which is one of the two major daily newspapers in Chicago. And the front page was all about the debate on Gaza. And so these demonstrations, these inside the hall, outside the hall demands for attention to what's going on in Gaza were successful on another level. And that is that they made a lot of the media refocus on this attention or on this issue. And was it sufficient? No, it's never sufficient, but it was meaningful. And I do think that the outcry, the demand was consequential.
And in terms of Harris's remarks, let's talk about the consequence.
Well, I mean, I think it was impossible for her to give a speech after this week and not talk about Gaza. Now, remember, we've experienced an awful lot of politics in this country that never mentions Palestine, right? That never mentions, certainly doesn't mention Gaza, but just in general, doesn't mention these issues. James Zogby, the great Arab American Institute president and activist.
And member of the DNC.
Longtime member of the DNC, notes that Palestine was first mentioned at a Democratic convention in 1984 when he was
by
speaking.
By Jesse Jackson?
No, it was mentioned by Zogby.
Oh, by Zogby.
Speaking
okay.
for Jesse Jackson. And then it was second mentioned in 1988 by Zogby when he was speaking for Jackson. And then it wasn't mentioned afterward, right? So we have this long history of it not being mentioned. Kamala Harris comes to the stage. She is going to give a foreign policy statement. And she, I think going in knew that there had to be a mention of Gaza. Remember, President Biden mentioned the protests and mentioned these issues in his speech. So it'd be absurd if she didn't. What was striking about it is that her mention was much longer than I think your usual kind of political calculation. The usual political calculation is throw the word in and get on quickly because it's controversial. You don't want people to you know, get mad at you or whatever. I will give Kamala Harris credit. It was a relatively, in the scheme of these things, relatively lengthy mention, which did show respect for Palestinians. In fact, talked about self-determination.
I was just going to say, use the crucial phrase self-determination. Now, self-determination is not the same as statehood. So again, it's another kind of compromise formation, but you haven't heard an American potential president talk about Palestinian self-determination probably since Bill Clinton.
Yeah, and talk about it in a political context, right? Not talking about it as president trying to get negotiations going or something.
Exactly.
That was significant. However, with that said, you still had a situation where it was aspirational, and kind of broadly aspirational, with a sense of urgency, saying we've got to get the ceasefire, but not the sort of statement that, you know, I think many people would like to see, which would be that next step to say, look, and there is a way to do this. It's been
well, or a statement that said, I mean, you know, it said first of all that America is always going to keep supplying defensive weapons to Israel. So there, you know, she explicitly rejected the calls for an arms embargo. Although she left some room for ceasing shipping offensive weapons, but she didn't say they were going to do that. She didn't mention the name Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. She didn't say anything about Israel's obstructionist tactics in terms of negotiations. So, and she very forthrightly condemned Hamas mm-hmm. As a terrorist organization responsible for the murders on October 7th. So, you know, it was an attempt to thread a needle. Will it be enough in Michigan? I don't know.
I think that people always run this through the framework of Michigan, and I understand that because Michigan Southeastern Michigan especially has a very large Arab American population, large Muslim population, large Palestinian American population. I mean, it's got all these things in place. But it is important to understand that this is relevant in many, many other states as well, because you have large student populations in many places who've been deeply concerned about and engaged with these issues. And that youth vote in places like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, many other states is very, very relevant. There's also, frankly, just a for lack of a better term, a great mass of people across this country who care deeply about this issue. And I think that some of them were encouraged to hear the mention, encouraged to hear at least some of the tone. I think there will be many others who say this is still insufficient and it lacks the sense of urgency that at a time when we're talking about 40,000 people killed. And so,
of course, it's perfectly possible to believe that this was an insufficient gesture and to believe that enabling the election of Donald Trump would be far worse for the cause of Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think,
and, you know, you heard a certain amount of that discussion this week on the sidelines of the convention, not so much during the demonstrations, but talking to people about how they responded to the demonstrations.
There's simply no question of that. In fact, many people, you know, people come to that opinion at different points and in different ways, right? And they're looking for encouragement. Those who have decided that they're going to vote for Harris, despite their deep frustration with the Biden-Harris administration as regards Palestine, they're looking for encouragement, right? They're looking for some sign. And I think that that's what the Harris people recognized. They recognized that this mention in this speech in this way gives those people who are already probably going to vote for him, or at least in the zone, it gives them a lot more encouragement. And I think, you know, from a moral standpoint, the statement needed to be in the address. From a practical political standpoint, it also needed to be there. And it is it's a significant part of what we saw in the whole of this convention, because when you end a convention with at least a reference to an understanding of an issue that was so alive through the whole process, that does show at the very least that Kamala Harris and the people around her are at least listening.
And that to some extent they get it. I mean, one of the things that struck me talking to uncommitted delegates during the week was, you know, there were some young people, there were some demonstrators outside the convention. There were signs saying, you know, boycott Harris. There was a, you know, never Harris. But the delegates, the actual uncommitted delegates I talked to, were essentially desperate for encouragement and permission. And, you know, was this enough? This was certainly encouragement. Was it permission? We'll have to see. But let's talk a little bit about the contrast between this convention and the convention we both attended in Milwaukee. Now, of course, that was in your home state, so in many respects, it was better. But it was certainly better organized. But what struck me was, you know, here's a name you don't hear a lot in the Nation magazine circles: George Will. George Will wrote a book about what he called soulcraft. And that politics is not just a policy issues and quid pro quo agenda. And what struck me very strongly was the way in which the Democrats were, in a sense, in a different dimension or on a different level, not just a different mood, but they were doing something very different in their convention than the Republicans were, which was essentially saying, we want to heal the country. We are the people who can heal this country. We are the people who can bring people together. You know, the Republican convention was very much us and them, and we are going to beat them again. We are going to get our revenge. We are going to come back into power. We are going to be, as Trump says, your retribution. And this was a very different process and mood.
Yeah, I think... for lack of a better term, this was an adult convention. Whereas the Republican convention with Hulk Hogan and everything, you know, it had an odd, odd lack of seriousness to it, even though there was this very dark sort of underpinning of the messaging. And I think that was a Republican effort in July to present the party as somehow more reasonable, less scary. They really did try at many, many turns to sort of dial down some of the image of extremism. And I think you felt that when you're talking to people, when you're moving around, there was that effort. But then it was all destroyed at the end of the convention by Trump's acceptance speech, in which he not only went three times as long as he was supposed to go, he literally had a roughly a 30-minute speech and spoke for, you know, better part of an hour and a half. But he also inserted kind of all the things that one would have hoped he was going to get, you know, kind of jettison, right, if you're a political Republican strategist. And so you ended up with Trump still being the leader of a cult of personality, delivering sort of his worst hits, not his greatest hits. And so it was a very unsuccessful end of the convention. They didn't get the kind of bump that they had hoped for, et cetera. Contrast that with the Democratic convention. Democratic convention was very theme-oriented, very message-oriented. They tried to deliver a lot of messages right up into the final night. It was very interesting who they scheduled, who was speaking, all of them trying to build into this closing address by Harris. And Harris's closing address was it was a very calculated address. It was delivered to speak to many, many communities with a range of messages, but in some sort of long arc of, as you say, healing, of a sort of a healthier direction for the country. And I think they succeeded in delivering it. The contrast between the conventions was so stark in this regard. At the Republican convention, there was a sense that there were plenty of issues they weren't going to discuss. There were plenty of things that they weren't going to do. They weren't going to try and dot every I and cross every T. At the Democratic convention, there was an effort to do that. It wasn't perfect, as we've just discussed, by any measure. But boy, if you're presenting an image to America and saying, here's someone who is capable of being president of the United States, whether you agree with them or not, here's somebody who can do the job. I think the contrast between the Democratic and Republican conventions is startling, right? Because Trump simply didn't try to do that. Maybe he did in his own head, but not in a realistic way. Whereas Kamala Harris, that was exactly what she tried to do, and frankly, exactly what many of the speakers who came before her tried to set up. So more successful.
There's another thought that's just struck me, which is, you know, the Republican convention, everybody was in a very good mood.
Very.
They assumed they were going to win. And unlike other Republican conventions I can recall, being there from the nation did not feel like a risky proposition. People were patronizing to me. You know, they felt sorry for being such a deluded left winger, but they were very pleasant. And also the whole presentation was of one of those horror movies where nobody takes it that seriously and everybody's having a good time. And there was definitely, if you think of it in movie genres, the Republican convention was a kind of funny horror movie. And the Democratic convention was a rom-com. And again, it was almost a literal rom-com. You had Kamala Harris's husband talking about their first date. You know, you had Tim Walz talking about his wife, Gwen, and you had these happy couples at the end, just like at the end of every rom-com has to end with a marriage. This was like, you know, two long-term marriages. And if you count the Clintons and the Obamas, Clintons, of course, a little
weaker.
Asterisk.
Yeah.
The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
But you know, it was like happily ever after.
Well, I think I like your analogy. I'm gonna kind of alter slightly and say it was an aspirational rom-com. It's sort of saying, you know, we would like to get to a place of some level of normalcy, And I think this is the fascinating thing about it, at least to me. I wrote a lot about Tim Walz's speech. And Tim Walz's speech was very short, by the way, which, by the way, again, ought to get marks at any convention, delivering a short, succinct speech.
Particularly when you're speaking on the same night as Bill Clinton,
amazingly lived up to his reputation and went long. But the thing about Tim Walz that was absolutely fascinating to me was that he recognized exactly the role of a candidate for vice president. And that is to try in no way to harm the candidate you're running with, right? First, do no harm. But secondly, to find ways that you can add to the appeal, right? Reach out in different ways. And weirdly enough, in a country that totally neglects rural America, by and large, both the Republican and the Democratic parties have tried with their vice presidential picks to make some kind of appeal to small towns, small city communities across this country, multiracial, multiethnic, because rural America is not simply, you know, white people. It is a great diversity of people out there, not often talked to. And whereas the Republicans went with J.D. Vance, whose, you know, message to rural America is, you know, I actually grew up in a mid-sized city, but I visited rural America and I wrote a book about it.
And also, you're hurting and it's your own damn fault.
Yes, it's a horrible message. It's a horrible, horrible message to rural America. Whereas here you have Tim Walz, who gets up there and says, yeah, I came from this incredibly small town and went to a high school with 24 people in it. None of them went to Yale. Very a subtle, good Midwestern dig at Vance. And then he delivered a vision of values. Now, I will tell you this, having lived in very urban areas and very rural areas, those values cross. I mean, it's not like somehow rural people are nicer or rural people are better. But it was this notion of there's a set of values, and those values are about taking care of your neighbor, taking care of someone who you may not even know that well, maybe don't agree with, but you're not going to let them down. If their car goes off the road in a snowstorm, you're going to help them get it back on the road. And that,
which by the way, is an experience that all of us who live in
the North,
whoever lived in rural America, the North, have had.
Right. It's human. And that's what I want to emphasize. There are two ways to look at this thing. J.D. Vance wants to look at it. And frankly, the Trump team wants to look at it as, you know, fear, right? Alienation. We want you angry and we want you to vote for us because you're angry. Whereas,
we want you to be suspicious of everybody that you don't know very well.
That's right. And then here you have Tim Walz come along and say, no, quite the opposite, right? It's not about fear and anger. It's about doing your best for other folks. It's about being open to people who may not be the same as you, but are human beings and that you can help them out. Maybe they can help you out. That is a very subtle but very powerful message, I think, for expanding the appeal of the Harris-Walz ticket. And I really thought that, quite frankly, what Walz took us back to, without saying it, I wish he had mentioned the name, he took us back to the Paul Wellstone vision. And the Paul Wellstone vision was a urban-rural coalition against powerful interests that really don't care about us no matter where we live. And that is, he didn't tweak it out quite as far as I would have liked him to, but I will say that in combination with Harris, it is a message that says this ticket can have appeal beyond the standard zones of battleground states that where they usually work. And if in 2024, Democrats actually do go from strength to strength, if their poll numbers go up and they have a chance to expand the map, right, within swing states out to areas where Democrats don't always win, so you run your margins up, in states that maybe haven't been swing states but could be brought into the mix. I saw a lot of that messaging sort of floating through this convention. Again, we use the word aspirational. I think it's a good one because I think this was an aspirational convention. Not perfect messaging, but messaging that aimed toward, you know, a campaign that says, you know, we don't have to run in just six states or seven battleground states. We may run in 8 to 10 states. We may run in 12 states.
Well, so let's talk about that, because after all, this is horse race coverage.
It is horse race.
So we've got the swing states. We've got Michigan. We've got Wisconsin. We've got Pennsylvania. We've got North Carolina. We've got Georgia. We've got Nevada. We've got Arizona. Where does the map expand from there?
Sure. And in fact, you heard it at the convention. People actually saying it at the convention. Like in the roll call, which was actually very well done. Some of them were essentially saying, hey, you know, hey, come our way. And I think your first expansion, which has already been to some extent acknowledged, is probably toward Florida. Florida has an abortion rights referendum on the ballot. So too do a number of other states. These referendums are seen as not just important ways to protect rights, but also as tools that can mobilize voters who might not otherwise come to the polls. I happen to think they're maybe less necessary now because the mobilization may be advanced by the fact that Harris is now the leader of the ticket. But the core message here is that I think Democrats are looking at Florida as a potential state to go into. I think that you will see them also look at, I think they'll take another look at Ohio. As hard as Ohio has been for them in recent years, remember, it was only 12 years ago that Barack Obama and Sherrod Brown won Ohio with ease, right? And so Sherrod Brown's still running there. So I think they're going to look there. And here's, Texas was clearly trying to make an appeal that they be thought of in this way. One of the things I'll emphasize to you, though, is that when you expand the map, there's an internal debate within political parties. And it is, if we expand the map, we're going to have to put money there. And we're going to take candidate time there. And as a result, expanding the map becomes a controversial idea, right? People will say,
well, because it's cheaper and easier to fight an election in seven states.
That's right, to win narrow, right?
Right.
But winning narrow is not going to be sufficient at all this time, because you've got the Senate in play. You have to, Harris becoming president with a Republican Senate is going to take a lot of air out of this, if indeed she wins, right? And so they have to start looking, playing a little bit of multidimensional chess, right? And so when we talk about expanding the map, I think you have to look at states like Missouri, where there is a pretty good deal Senate race going on. I think you have to look at maybe even as difficult as it has become in recent years, a state like Iowa, because Iowa has at least two congressional districts where if the Democratic ticket at the top did well, even if it didn't win, if it did quite well, you might flip a couple congressional districts. And that's the bottom line. I always wonder if the Democratic Party will ever wrap its head around this, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting because if you think about Ohio, so when the Republicans, when Trump selected J.D. Vance, I thought that's it. That's going to be really bad for Sherrod Brown. I mean, I assumed that they were going to lose Ohio in the presidential, but I was more worried about Sherrod Brown at that point
because
he's somebody we can't afford to lose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then when she picked Tim Walz, I thought this can't hurt Sherrod Brown. It may help him. It will certainly help John Tester because mm-hmm. Tim Walz is like John Tester designed in a lab. You know?
Well said. And, you know, as John Tester, who I've known for many years, would tell you, the only difference being more fingers. And because John Tester, of course, famously emphasizes that in a farm accident, he lost some of his fingers. He's such a working class, working farmer guy. But you know, Minnesota, that southern Minnesota where Tim Walz represented in Congress, traditionally a Republican district that he won and then held for many, many years. That isn't so different from northern Iowa. It isn't so different from eastern Nebraska. Remember, Walz grew up in Nebraska. That's another state where you could pick up a congressional seat and there even an electoral vote. What I'm saying here is, if we look at this convention from a tactical standpoint, I saw a lot of emphasis on that notion of how to get out there, how to expand the map. Now, the question is, were they being nice to the delegates who came to Chicago? Were they just kind of saying, hey, thanks for coming. Yeah, maybe we'll come see you sometime. Or are they really taking it seriously?
Yeah, well, that's, and you know, because this campaign is such a sprint, I believe we are now 74 days out.
Yeah.
It's interesting because while Harris and her campaign have not, I'm knocking wood here as I say this, have not put a foot wrong since she became the presumptive nominee, The same cannot be said of the Democratic National Committee, which, by the way, did a terrible job of organizing lots of this convention in terms of having 4 years to plan for 30,000 people in Chicago and still making not just, you know, poor working reporters like me, but big donors and bundlers stand in line for 90 minutes to get into the convention some nights. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I still wouldn't trust Jamie Harrison to run my country. Or the Democratic National Committee, frankly, to run, as we say in England, to piss up in a brewery. But the Harris campaign does seem to be very competently run. So far, they've been making terrific calls. One of the calls that they seem to have made that I wanted to mm-hmm. raise with you is class.
Yeah.
Because I heard more talk about class, both explicitly, middle class, working class. Mm-hmm. I heard working class from Sean Fain, of course, who was very eloquent on that front. Harris doesn't go to working class. She describes her family as middle class. And of course, that's easier and a more popular position. But there was also a real class war component against Trump and Vance in terms of how everybody who spoke last night, I felt bad for poor Ruben Gallego, who had to admit that although he'd grown up poor and slept on the floor, he'd gone to Harvard.
Oh, he did fine, and he gave a very effective speech. And frankly, you're talking some about the logistics of the convention. There's always things like that, and I understand that not everything is perfect. I think part of the problem the convention had was it became a much more popular convention when Harris came in, and I think there was a sense of being a little bit overwhelmed by that. I'm going to give him I'll give you a pass on that. What I do think that is much more important is that yes. On that stage, you did hear some real class-oriented messaging. That was in Walz's speech quite
Very
a bit.
Much.
It was certainly in the speech of many of the labor folks who spoke. So one of the striking speakers, he had a young guy from West Virginia who got up on the final night and gave he works with More Perfect Union, and gave a very class-focused address to the convention, which, by the way, was wildly well-received, right? And so I do think that what we're talking about here is a convention that understands it's running against a billionaire, right? And I think that was a challenge for Democrats. They didn't fully wrap their head around how to do that in 2016 and even to some extent in 2020. And the one thing I will say that I think is important to that is that when you say you're running against the billionaire class, as Bernie Sanders did in a very well-received address, which, by the way, also mentioned Gaza in a strong way. But when Bernie Sanders said that, it was very, very well-received and obviously important. What was vital, though, is that other people were saying it, right? It was woven through the convention. And one of the things that struck me was at this convention, every time you mentioned unions, whether it was Joe Biden doing it, whether it was a union leader doing it, whether it was some actor or actress or you know, entertainer getting up there and saying, I'm a union member, this, when you mentioned it, the whole crowd went wildly enthusiastic.
I saw that last night with Eva Longoria.
That's right.
When she said, and a union member, and people, that's when people stood up and shouted.
And so this is my point. That is vital, because just saying that you don't like Trump because he's a billionaire, that's one thing. That's a good message, not bad. As Sanders and I have both said, billionaires shouldn't exist. But that you then take it that next step and you say, well, what's the counterbalance? How do we fight against this? Strong unions. And boy, that crowd just totally got it. It totally got the power of unions. And that's one of the things I'm right about for next week. Because I one of the dangers of conventions is, and as journalists who cover them, we kind of push everything out in 4 days, right? And then we think, okay, we're done. You know, then we're going to go on to the next thing. I think conventions are an effort where a party tries to bring itself together, tries to focus its message, tries to, you know, accomplish a lot of things. It is wise to look back at that, you know what I mean? To kind of dig deeper,
yes,
as we're trying to do. And one of the things I'm going to look at next week is, you know, whether this kind of deeper understanding of the role of unions can translate into this campaign. And so it becomes, you know, not just seeking a union endorsement, but also Harris and Walz and others talking about how meaningful it would be for America if instead of the level of unionization we have now, we had twice as many people, three times as many people unionized, and what it would mean if you had a administration and Congress that was going to try and do that. Frankly, the appeal of that word at the convention suggests to me there's a possibility that there would be an appeal outside the convention. And one of the arguments I'll make is, you know, take this show on the road.
Well, yes. Also, in terms of taking the show on the road, I mean, the theme of the convention very much was unification, unity, solidarity. Those are all good union words, but they're also good political words generally.
Yeah.
And not without a cost. I mean, I think one of the reasons that the uncommitted campaign didn't have more traction is because a lot of delegates regarded it as a threat to their newfound unity. You know, yeah. It's like, don't come and harsh our buzz.
Yeah, that's a wrong approach.
It was mistaken, but yeah. it was a thing that at least I heard fairly often on the floor. So I guess my question is, you know, are there other stars of this convention that you want to single out?
Sure. I will tell you that the stars of the convention, in my view, were many, right? There are a lot. And it's hard to keep track of all of them. But I will say that Sean Fain delivered a speech that absolutely, I think, blew people away, not just on the floor, but watching it from afar. And it was a very important speech. And he actually created a good new slogan, Trump is a scab. I think that AOC, on the same night, really positioned herself in a new way, not merely as a member of the squad and all the things that she has been, but really as somebody who's ready to become a national leader of the party. And her speech was a very, very important speech. I think an incredibly well-received one. I think that when we talk about other stars of the convention, you know, there are, I think Ruben Gallego, who came out on the last night, Senate candidate in Arizona, he really nailed it and hit a lot of the themes. When I listened to Ruben Gallego, I thought, you know, this is the guy who's running for the Senate right now. He could be a presidential candidate. And then finally, I'm going to close off with Raphael Warnock, who, frankly, in my opinion, delivered a speech that if he was the nominee, it would have been a pretty darn good acceptance speech.
Yes. No, it was very striking, the depth of the Democratic bench. To your list, I'm going to add three names, only one of them a politician. Michelle Obama, if she ever changes her mind about politics, she could probably be nominated by acclamation. Oprah Winfrey, who delivered an incredibly powerful speech. Now, of course, she's a very polished performer, but she doesn't usually get quite so political, and I thought she was very effective. And interestingly, she had asked to come, I gather, and they made the right call in giving her time, I think. And finally, a politician who kind of changed my mind in his speech, and that's Pete Buttigieg, who really did seem able to summon quite powerful political emotions as well as political ideas. So, you know, let us hope that we've got at least 8 years of Kamala Harris, but the Democrats have a very interesting bench and it was lovely to see them. All right, John, it's been great talking to you. Let's hope this unity lasts. What do you think? Yes or no?
I think yes. I think it was a successful convention. And if they can put together a convention with this level of unity, it's not that hard to take it on the road.
All right. A pleasure. See you soon.
Thank you, brother.